you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Brain power. It's not sufficient for career success, but it sure helps. That's so true now that it's a cliche that the well-paying jobs of tomorrow will require ever higher levels of cognitive functioning. And employers and career experts, and especially policymakers, are doing a lot of hand-wringing about what to do about the countless people whose cognitive functioning isn't high enough to be, quote, high-performing thinkers. Will an acceptably high, an unacceptably high percentage of Americans be relegated to menial, very low-paying jobs? Or even relegated to long-term unemployment? What could offer realistic hope for these workers? We've long placed all our bets on improving people's environment, their education, their job retraining, self-esteem programs, things like that. But some people, like my guest, the Vice President for Research at Michigan State University, Dr. Stephen Hsu, are finding that we may gain additional hope in biologically improving our cognitive functioning. But even if that becomes practical, do the risks and the ethical concerns make that something we should prohibit, just as we prohibit performance-enhancing drugs in sports? Steve Hsu earned his B.S. from Caltech, his Ph.D. from Berkeley, and was a Harvard Fellow. He then went on to be a professor at Yale, and then a full professor of theoretical physics at the University of Oregon. And as I mentioned, now he is Michigan State University's Vice President for Research and Graduate Studies, and is collaborator and scientific advisor to BGI's Cognitive Research Lab, which, among other things, is comparing the genomes of 2,000 people with high cognitive functioning with a control group of average people. Steve Hsu, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Glad to be here, Marty.
Good. Now, are the, you know, you've been studying these genomes now for a couple of years, I believe. Are the genomes of average people very different from those of people with high cognitive functioning?
Well, there are subtle differences, and we're still at an early stage in this investigation. If I had to make a rough estimate, I'd say there are probably something like 10,000, of order 10,000, loci in the genome that are affecting variations in cognitive ability.
10,000 loci, 10,000 places. Now, human beings share 99% of the genomes with other animals, for example, you know, other primates. So, you know, isn't that an enormous, you know, an enormous difference?
Well, if there are 3 billion loci in your genome and you differ at 1% from some other species, that's actually quite a lot of different places.
Doesn't it really only require, you know, theoretically, if only, you know, 2 or 3 places are different, wouldn't that be enough to explain behavior? I mean, somebody who's got one, who's missing one gene, you know, on a gene, on chromosome 15 trisomy, you know, where he's got three genes instead of 2, that's enough to create, for example, profound retardation. So wouldn't 10,000 differences in a genome be more than enough to explain enormous differences in cognitive functioning?
So there are definitely single genes of large effect that can, for example, render someone mentally retarded, make them deaf, etc. For normal variation within the population, you are talking about individual genes, each of which have a tiny effect, and it's the sum of those many thousands of effects that lead to the distribution that we see around us in society.
And if you were to, you know, they say he who lives by the crystal ball eats broken glass, but given the admittedly, as you say, preliminary data on this, if you were to project forward 5 to 10 years and guess what we would end up knowing, are you a completely agnostic on what we would learn about how, you know, what sort of, under what sorts of control cognitive functioning is, or what would you, or do you have a quasi-educated guess as to what the status of our knowledge will be 5 to 10 years from now?
Well, let me first say that from what I call classical studies of twins and adoptions, mm-hmm. we already know quite a bit about how heritable cognitive ability is.
So how heritable is it?
Two twins with the same genetic makeup who are raised in different families, nevertheless, end up fairly similar. So we can quantify what fraction of the variation is under control of the genes and what fraction is under control of the environment.
Is there unanimity among studies about that? And if so, what's the what's kind of the modal percentage that is assigned to genetics versus environment these days?
Whereas 30 years ago, there was a strong debate about whether it was fully environmental or fully genetic. Now the debate among experts is what percentage is controlled by genes versus environment. And typically the numbers range from 50% to 80%. And a very important caveat is that when we know that very, very poor environments can cause large negative effects, here we're talking about people who are in the normal range of environments, so good homes, good upbringings. And then in that case, a significant fraction of the variation is influenced by genes.
Good homes. I mean, I know that in the real extremes, obviously, if you put somebody in a closet and basically starve them, clearly there's going to be a major decrement in their functioning because of their environment. But how good a home are we talking about? If somebody, let's say, is growing up in a working class, or even somebody whose family is supported by government assistance, and but they're not locked in a closet. Do we have a sense for folks like that who have a kind of a minimal, quote, quasi-normal environment, is there any consensus around what percentage of that person's cognitive functioning is affected by their environment? In other words, difference in schools, yes. Different in peers, parents, versus the genetic stuff?
Yes. If I define the range of environments to be those in which a family would still be allowed to adopt a child, so typically they're screened by welfare agencies,
right,
or adoption agencies. So they don't necessarily have to be even middle class. They could be slightly below middle class, but still allowed to adopt.
Sure.
So in that range of humane environments, that we obtain numbers like 50% to 80% heritability.
Okay. Let's turn to the study that I just read about in Nature, one of our more prestigious publications. And it indicates that parents who participate in virtual fertilization, that is, they're either by choice or usually because they're having difficulty fertilizing the old-fashioned way, they have their sperm and eggs. Traditionally, they've been evaluated simply for morphology, for their structure, does it look normal? But apparently, this new study in Nature is suggesting that parents who do use in virtual fertilization are soon going to be able to fully genotype the eggs and perhaps sperm before deciding which to implant. What's your best guess as to what's going to literally be possible? Of course, without coercion, what the Nazis did was, of course, absolutely reprehensible about trying to create a master race and coercion and all that. But let's assume that we are not going to be quite that nefarious. But in 5 to 10 years from now, what options do you think prospective parents will have regarding trying to ensure at least the normalcy of the cognitive functioning of their kids? So, again, because the show focuses on work, so that they can be starting out their life without a genetic one or two strikes against them and have a reasonable shot at more than minimal survival wage work in our workforce of tomorrow.
I believe that in 10 to 20 years, it's possible that we'll have enough information about the genetic architecture of cognitive ability and also the additional technologies required for someone to be able to genotype an embryo while making a fertility decision about which of the embryos to implant. I believe those two components will be in place 10 to 20 years from now.
You're writing. I'm sorry. Please go ahead. I'm sorry. Please continue.
And how society chooses to utilize that technology is, of course, up to the people that govern the society, which is us. I would anticipate, however, before governments get their act together and decide what they think of this new technology, already wealthy people will probably be using it to some degree.
I imagine
that the first thing that will happen is people who can afford this kind of technology will start to use it. there'll be some early adopters, but then eventually society will have to decide what it wants to do.
And, of course, that brings up the first of many ethical questions about such things, because one of the concerns that certainly as with this upcoming election is occurring as one of the defining characteristics, defining differences between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, or is the sense that Romney is more likely to exacerbate the differences between rich and poor, ultimately. And so there is that ethical question. If we make something commercially available and the rich are going to use it, is it not going to exacerbate the difference between rich and poor? And is that a, you know, is that fair that rich people should be able to use their money discretionarily that way? Or is that, you know, or is that an ethical violation? That's a complicated question. We'll get to more of those ethical concerns in a minute. But when you talk about from 10 to 20 years that parents are likely to be able to make that choice, in your writings, you make a rather exciting or incendiary, depending upon your view, claim that very likely in that 10 to 20 years that the amount of enhancement, cognitive enhancement, that a prospective parents would be able to engender with genetic enhancement is profound. Right now, 99% of people's cognitive functioning, at least as we measure it, is within two standard deviations of average. And I'm going to explain what that means in a minute for those of you who don't understand statistics, but I don't blame you at all. You predict that genetic enhancement could enable cognitive functioning to increase by 30 standard deviations, not two, higher than today's average. So, for example, today's average SAT score, many of us are familiar with the SAT, is 1,000, or at least by the old scoring system, 1,000, with a standard deviation of, roughly 100. Well, according to your prediction, that would enable people to have an SAT score of 4,000, not 1,000. How clear in your mind, I know you're not an ethicist, but you've obviously thought a lot about this, how clear is it that the world would net positively benefit in the workplace and the larger society from a significant subset of families who choose to have their kids' SAT scores or cognitive functioning raised to 4,000?
Well, the 4,000 number is, of course, ill-defined because we've not had people in history far beyond 5 or 6 standard deviations above average because it's an exponential distribution.
Right.
So if you look at those individuals who are at the very top in terms of their intellectual capabilities, often they made substantial contributions. So John von Neumann, who is often referred to as one of the smartest people in the 20th century, although he's not very well known to the general public, he played a crucial role in the early development of computers and computer architecture. He was a mathematician and a physicist. Einstein, Feynman, all of these people made tremendous contributions to modern day technology. And so if you're a techno optimist, you sort of welcome a future in which there are more people like that who can make great contributions.
Let's turn to, let me let our listeners know, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. As we well know, brain power is not sufficient, but certainly a necessary component of success in what everybody agrees is an ever more knowledge-based society, where at least the non-menial, decent-paying jobs are going to require a fair measure of brain power that we talk about in terms of creativity or cognitive ability or intellectual fluency or whatever. And we have, on this show certainly, and throughout society, we have explored the full range of attempts to change the environment of folks to try to improve their cognitive abilities. And that's certainly, no matter what, the studies do suggest that certainly environment matters. But I thought I would devote one segment of one show to the other side of things. We all acknowledge that we are all a function of our genes and our environment. Every mother who's had two or more kids knows their kid emerges from the womb quite differently. And so I'm talking with arguably, well, I'll just say one of the world's leading experts on the potential enhancement of cognitive functioning by understanding the genetics of matters. And indeed, Steve Hsu is, in addition to being the vice president for research at Michigan State University, he is a collaborator and scientific advisor to the BGI Cognitive Research Lab, which is, among other things, comparing the genomes of 2,000 people with high cognitive functioning with a group of average people. You were talking before I made this little announcement talking about the fact that we can certainly point to some people who, because of their extreme intelligence, have made enormous contributions. But the what you call the techno-optimist, but a techno-pessimist would say it only takes one or two truly nefarious types to use that great power to great destruction. I mean, I've, for example, let's say I was a slightly crazy but absolutely brilliant person. There is no reason why I couldn't, for example, take something as simple as the standard smallpox virus, mutate it by doing some changed genes, and release it in the lobby of an international airline terminal, thereby infecting thousands of people who are about to scatter around the world and perhaps even causing near Armageddon. Is not the risk-reward ratio of unleashing such a technology where somebody could have a equivalent of a 4,000 SAT score, is the risk too great in your judgment? I know you're just guessing, but this is an interesting conversation, at least as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it's obviously very, very speculative to think about things like this. And I should add that saying that rudimentary genetic selection for certain traits might be possible in 20 years, even that is speculation.
Mm-hmm.
But let me just say that, you know, we have had very intellectually gifted criminals like the Unabomber who managed to kill a few people. But if you look at the impact that the Unabomber had versus the impact that a vaccine for HIV or a cure for cancer might have, I guess I have to remain in the optimist camp.
Well, you know, part of the purpose of a talk show host is to ask some of the hard questions. And so there is a piece of me, and this isn't, I'm not just doing this to say so, but there's an honest piece of me. I kind of think of myself as a techno-neutral rather than an optimist or a pessimist. But certainly one argument, you know, we live in tight budget times, and the cost of trying to genetically understand the bases of this complicated variable called intelligence and then create therapies, you know, there's a good argument that can be made that it's a waste of money, that it's a poor relative use of money. That cognitive performance is affected by so many things. To make a search for a cognitive gene cluster is foolish. For example, a person's cognitive functioning is caused by the variance of genes in the genome and exome, plus molecules involved in the expression of those genes, plus the aforementioned environmental factors, home life, school life, your peers. The media affects how well we cognitively think. And cognitive ability is not enough to ensure high functioning in the real world. I mean, we all know intelligent people who function terribly in the real world. So might it really be a terrible use of research dollars and of efforts from smart guys like you? Shouldn't you be redirecting your efforts to something more likely to bear fruit than identifying a gene cluster for cognitive ability?
Well, you're pointing down the speculative road. I think most scientists are curiosity driven, and if they can learn something about the genetic architecture of intelligence or the genetic architecture of any number of cognitive abilities, they would be interested to do so. And at this point, it's just basic science. And in fact, it's quite inexpensive basic science relative to my main field of research is high energy physics, and we spend tens of billions of dollars on giant accelerators to probe questions in high energy physics. So actually, research in human genomics is quite a bit cheaper.
Forgetting about the cost, though, I want to return to something we kind of skirted through, which is certainly among, you know, a public radio audience, the liberal audience of San Francisco, is a major concern, and that is anything that would exacerbate the difference between rich and poor's achievement would be viewed as anathema. And as you say, people, let's say government, first of all, as you say, probably first, rich people will use it to enhance their kids' intelligence, thereby exacerbating the difference between rich and poor. And while government sometimes and often does provide, for example, under Medicare or under Obamacare, medical services for the poor, even if they can't afford it, it will be subsidized by the government. But it may be deemed that something, especially for the first 20 or 30 years of its existence, if such a gene therapy to enhance intelligence existed, government may well not fund it for the poor, and then wouldn't that additionally exacerbate the difference between the haves and have-nots? And can you justify it when we, at least in America, are wringing our hands about the enormous gap between the intellectual haves and the intellectual have-nots?
I think if you step back and you if you analyze these questions in the context of a free market economy, you'll find that any new technology that enhances learning, for example, like a computer or an iPad, will at first exacerbate the gap between the haves or have-nots. If we invent a revolutionary way to teach algebra, I assume that rich people will get their hands on it first. So any new technological development will fall into the hands of the rich before it falls into the hands of everyone else. So I don't think there's anything not in particular unique about other, you know, genetic technologies in that context.
Well, something that, you know, is another deep concern that many people would have would be that doing the research that would enable the genomic enhancement of cognitive functioning is something that some governments might mandate. They might mandate gene therapy to ensure that its overall population has high cognitive ability. I mean, China has invoked a one-child policy. If they could restrict couples or individuals' choice to, you know, how many babies to have, could not governments, you know, remember the 200 countries in the world, could not some governments require all couples to have their sperm and eggs checked to make sure they have the genomes for high intelligence, high motivation, whatever? And is that a frightening restriction on human freedoms, and therefore should we not let the genie out of the bottle?
Well, as an American, I'm obviously against the government enforcing or compelling people to follow a particular reproductive policy. I think individuals should make their own choices. However, it's amusing that on the one hand, people will complain if, say, rich people opt to do something and the poor people can't afford to do it, but then they don't want necessarily the government to get involved and provide it to everyone. So I think society will have to find a middle way which is acceptable to everyone.
I want to return to one other thing, you know, and this is not an ethical concern, but this is simply the fact that, you know, we all know, even though we're learning now, that even political affiliation has certainly a large environmental component, but a genetic component. There is something about risk, and liberals tend to be more risk-oriented, and conservatives want to change less, partly because there apparently is something cognitively in the genome about risk avoidance. So because this show focuses on work so much, we all know, any employer knows, that intelligence is only one attribute contributing to career success. Things like ambition and drive and ethics are others. Is there any information at this point that suggests whether there is a significant genetic as well as an environmental component to these other crucial attributes for career and workplace success?
The attributes you described are often characterized by psychologists as personality traits.
Right.
And while those are not as easily measured as, for example, IQ, they are somewhat measurable by psychologists. And yes, they are found to be somewhat heritable, perhaps somewhat a little bit less heritable than IQ, but perhaps comparably so.
And the last question I want to ask you, I have a couple more. You know, in addition to your being the vice president for research at Michigan State University, you do head the Cognitive Genomics Program at BGI, which is the new name for the Beijing Genomics Institute, which is funded both by the Chinese government and by investors worldwide, including the U.S. And BGI, you know, I just noticed you purchased the American company Complete Genomics. It's one of the cutting-edge genomics companies. Is China studying issues such as the genomics of intelligence more than U.S. companies and the U.S. government is? And if so, why?
So a few corrections. One, okay. I'm not the head of the group. I'm a member of the group.
Right,
and
sorry.
I'm an advisor to the lab.
Right.
Secondly, BGI is a private entity. It's not actually a government entity. It's a private corporation, although it had its origins in what was a government research lab.
I see.
Is there a general policy in China that's different from the U.S. policy regarding genetics research? No, they're actually pretty similar. is BGI a special organization that's willing to take risks and try to do interesting science? Yes, that's certainly true.
Last question. As I've been trying to assert through the show focuses mainly on career issues. And so I want to ask, end with a very practical career question. There was a movie a million years ago in 1968, The Graduate, and Dustin Hoffman, who was the lead character, got one word of career advice, and that word was plastics. If you had a brother or a son who, you know, anywhere between 18 and 45 or 50, when they were still thinking about what career they should pursue or redirect their efforts to, in 2013, the word probably would not be plastics. But what do you think the one word of advice you would give to people regarding their career is instead of plastics?
I don't think plastics was a great thing to say to Dustin Hoffman in the movie. Similarly, I can't think of any single word that's useful to all people in that age group pursuing their careers. How about this? People, not plastic.
Tell me more. Why don't you, we'll say we, you know, you're not limited to one word. Talk as long as you feel is appropriate.
Well, I would say there are some obvious technologies that are going to be more and more important as we go forward. Not everybody is capable of working in industries which are highly technical, but I think industries associated with big data, increasing amounts of data and drawing conclusions from that data, that's a huge growth industry. Genomics is rapidly becoming an information science, and as such, it is an example of an area where there are big opportunities.
I guess I do have one more question for you from a career perspective. You have seen the world from a couple of very different vantage points. You have been both a student and a faculty member at some of the most prestigious institutions in the world, research universities, and now you're VP of research at Michigan State. But you also do work for this quite cutting-edge private company, BGI. For people who are unsure, you know, who may have advanced degrees, the conventional wisdom is that the holy grail, what you should search for, is an academic position. I'd like you to kind of close by saying what you view as the dispassionate pros and cons of trying for a person who's got a PhD or an MD PhD or even an MPH or whatever, finding his or her career in the academic sphere versus the corporate sphere.
What I often tell my graduate students is that they should not pursue an academic research career unless they are so driven by their curiosity and interest in learning that they could not be happy in any other job. And the reason I say that is because most people who are qualified enough to be a tenured professor or capable enough to be a tenured professor in some scientific research area could, if they went in the private sector, make much more money and have a much better lifestyle. And so you have to be conscious of the fact that you're trading material gain against satisfaction of your own curiosity or intellectual drive. And you should consciously determine whether you want to make that trade-off before you do it.
I would add one thing, and I'm curious what you think. It's the probabilities of landing a tenure-track research job, even if you were a strong PhD, unless you're truly a superstar, you've gone to Caltech, your dissertation was a breakthrough, etc., and you have a clear pipeline into a research, you know, a set of research grants that are going to get funded by NIH or whatever, the chances are really quite poor. And so focusing on, exclusively on that, unless you're that superstar, entails too great a risk to put all your eggs in that basket, even if you are extremely passionate about the idea of discovery and you are curious. Do you think that's fair or unfair?
I think you described it perfectly. I think people who are trying to become a tenured professor in a competitive research area are taking a big risk. I have kids myself, and even if they turn out to be quite talented and passionate about it, I would make sure they understood those risks very well before making a decision.
Well, I'm glad I took the risk of having you as a guest on my show. You are terrific. I appreciate your coming on Work with Marty Nemco. Is there anything else you want to tell us before we say goodbye?
Well, I just want to say again that for the purposes of entertainment, we emphasize the speculative aspects of this subject. It's still a long way to go, although I think the most important thing people should be aware of is that because of advances in technology, the cost to sequence the genome of an organism, those costs have gone down by about a factor of a million in the last decade and will continue to decrease. So the world is changing. We had the computer and internet revolution. I think we're in the next 20 years, we're going to have the genomic revolution. Where it leads, though, nobody knows, and it's all speculation at this point.
Fair enough. I do, you know, while entertainment is of tertiary value, I like to think that this show focuses on the immediately practical, the short term, and the long term, and the really wise person moving forward, while not governed by long term predictions or trends, should certainly in the area of something as fundamental as cognitive functioning. It is not merely, I like to think, entertainment that we spend a few minutes chatting about this, even the speculative aspect. Do you buy that?
I do. Actually, although the genetic architecture of all this stuff remains to be elucidated, the general facts, for example, I mentioned twin studies and things like that, those studies are quite old now and well accepted. Nevertheless, if you read the newspaper, you would get the impression that we don't know much about this subject because it's so politically charged.
Well, indeed. Thank you very much for enlightening us somewhat beyond what we normally get from your daily newspaper. Thanks again. Steve Hsu, again, is the Vice President of Research at Michigan State University, and he is a contributor, collaborator, and member of the team of the genomics program at BGI. Thanks again for joining me.
Thanks, Marty. Have a great day.
You too. Be well. Okay. And now, because obviously, you know, while I have a PhD, this field is not my field. And we are very blessed. I don't know, as an atheist, I don't know if I should use the word blessed. We are fortunate in the Bay Area to have one of the nation's leading luminaries in the area of biotech and its practical implications, and a fine communicator. Indeed, I am a longtime fan of David Ewing Dungan, who is on our fellow public radio station, KQED, on Tech Nation, on Moira Gunn's Tech Nation. And we have David Ewing Dungan on the line, and I'm curious if you had any comments you wanted to make having listened to this interview.
Well, actually, thanks for having me on the show, Marty. I thought Dr. Hsu gave a pretty good overview of where we are. I found it intriguing, as many people in the physics and engineering field are, that he calls himself a techno-optimist, and you know, as a journalist, I'm trained to be a bit more skeptical, but I think the world he was talking about, or the possibilities in the future, and what you all were discussing, is a trajectory that we seem to at least be on. I mean, all you can really do about predicting the future, which is always hard and almost always wrong, is to identify current trajectories. And certainly in the area of cognition, there's a lot of exciting work going on. A lot of mechanistic work, not only in genetics, you focused on genetics, but other molecular factors that happen inside the body, proteins and how cells function, especially neurons in the brain, different parts of the brain. These are all areas that are moving at a very fast clip. And I personally am interested in us as a society seeing if we can get a little bit ahead of where these developments might take us, because it could profoundly reshape, how we view ourselves, not only as a country, our political system, our social system, but also even the essence of what makes us human.
Yeah. And so when you say staying getting ahead of it, that means it sounds like anticipating likely scientific outcomes and doing some smart thinking about the ethics and policy implications, what should be allowed and not. Is that what you mean?
Exactly. In fact, I just coincidentally happen to have an article in the New York Times Sunday Review today on can we use science to rebuild ourselves or to build a better self? And it's all about some of these issues, although it goes well beyond the cognitive. It gets into rebuilding ourselves physically, using bionics and all sorts of other techniques. But the point of that piece was that it's already happening. There are many places in technology, many aspects of technology that are already being used by quote-unquote healthy people or maybe people impaired by things like, say, sleep or aging. And these technologies are already being used to kind of get ahead, and so it's already here. But it's going to get a lot more interesting as we move ahead.
Well, that's interesting. So Huawei, I have you while the show focus on work. I mean, sleep, obviously, sleep. We are a nation that's sleep-deprived, and indeed people are not able to function and work well if they can't sleep. If they certainly the physiological aging, you know, there's a phrase of people in their 60s that they have a disease called CRS, can't remember, let's just say crap. Physical disabilities in the workplace, you know, places restrictions on the kind of work people can do. Can you give us some idea of what is currently available today and what ethical considerations are inherent?
Well, a couple of things that I mentioned in the Times piece and written about in other places as well. We have a couple stimulants right now that people are probably generally aware of, and some people probably are using.
Like coffee.
One of them is Adderall. You know, it's a kind of advanced amphetamine, which has been around for a little while. But you've got literally millions of healthy people, college students, professionals, using it. And researchers haven't really been able to determine if it actually gives you a true cognitive boost. But certainly if you're sleep deprived, you're trying to stay awake to take that final the next day or finish that paper or you got the big, I don't know, case, if you're a litigator or whatever you do. And then there's another drug, Provigil, which has been around a little less time, but still been here with us. It's a less, strong, it's not quite as strong a stimulant as Adderall, but that's used a lot, by people, jet lag, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, steroids. And one of the things that I researched in this piece, talking to experts in both the cognitive stimulants or neural stimulants and also the world of steroids, is that literally millions of people around the world take these drugs right now with apparently no particular side effects. There may be long-term damage. You know, modest doses. They're not, like, you know, pumping themselves full of this stuff every day. And, you know, they do get a bump, and they get an enhancement out of this. So that's happening now.
Well, isn't this really, the cognitive enhancement? It falls on a continuum from everything from drinking a cup of coffee, which has been long proven to improve cognitive functioning, to, for example, if I need to be at my cognitive best, I recognize you improve oxygenation in the brain by, you know, exercising. I do some of my best thinking while I'm running or in the shower. Which increases circulation of the brain. Or there's even some studies that say that chewing gum for 5 minutes improves cognitive functioning. So aren't those just simply points on the continuum with Adderall and Provigil further along the continuum? And then at the far end of the continuum is the future promising genetic enhancement?
Well, absolutely. And in fact, you have to hastily point out that it's not just high-tech enhancements. And we as a species, that's what we do. I mean, we're living in cities. We drive cars. We use computers. I have some eyeglasses. And, you know, these are all enhancements. And it kind of depends on where you begin to draw the line. But legally with something like Adderall or Provigil, these are pharmaceutical drugs, especially Adderall, you know, is an addictive, very powerful stimulant. And at the moment, we treat something like that as abuse. And, you know, the question in the future when you start getting into, you were talking genetics again, which, you know, has a lot of interesting developments, and we will see a lot from that. But what about things like surgically implanted, brain devices that bathe the frontal cortex where we make decisions, bathe it with electrons that boost us like no cup of coffee ever would? This is being experimented with on the outside of the brain. They attach electrodes to your forehead. I've had this done myself, and it immediately kicks your brain up into high gear. And I had one bioethicist, Tom Murray, from the Hastings Center in New York.
That's the Ethics Center,
Bioethics Center. Mm-hmm. He suggested that it might be immoral someday for somebody that we depend on, like a surgeon or the United States president, during a crisis, not to use some of these enhancements. So.
Interesting point. And how much of this, you know, we make an arbitrary decision on that which requires a prescription. But let's say, for example, you know, Adderall has been around for millions of years, or a thousand, you know, dozen, or, you know, Ritalin is where it started. These are all amphetamines. And doctors have been prescribing them to children all the time to get them to focus more in school. And there's evidence that about three quarters of students are significantly, their ability to focus and not be hated by their fellow peers and teachers is enhanced. You know, is it an artificial, draw, for bright line in the sand to say just because it requires a prescription, suddenly it takes another leap to being something we don't want to see people use?
Well, that's certainly been a criteria in the past, but doctors are allowed by law to prescribe drugs for pretty much anything, and they're of course going to not prescribe it if they want to keep their license for something that's dangerous. But many, many drugs are used that are pharmaceuticals for purposes other than those specifically approved by the FDA. But, you know, the mindset right now is that is all essentially, I mean, it's prescribed by a physician, it's not abuse. But Adderall, for instance, college kids, someone who has ADHD or has been diagnosed with that will get a prescription and then hand it out to his friends, before finals. That's a very common.
I see. That's a different story.
It happens right now. And, you know, as far as I can tell, there's a little research that's been done on this. This is not a recreational drug for these kids. Mm-hmm. It might have been back in my day in college, but it's not now. It literally is used in these high-pressure situations. And, of course, you get into all kinds of issues. Dr. Hsu mentioned some of these. Who gets them? Who can afford them? Mm-hmm. In a competitive society, how fair is it? And when you start getting into some of these more exotic enhancements, that is going to be a huge issue.
You bet. Before I let you go, you have a brand new book out. It's called When I'm 164, The New Science of Radical Life Extension and What Happens If It Succeeds. Obviously, again, I'm very aware that this show needs to focus on career, but if you give me a brief summary of some of the more non-obvious and interesting revelations that the book presents regarding life extension and what happens if it succeeds, what would you want to tell us?
Well, this is along the same lines of, it is speculative, but I think we can see where trends are heading. Life expectancy has almost doubled in the last 150 years through hygiene, nutrition, antibiotics, other med tech. And it's going to continue in that trajectory. But just to give you, the book talks about, it's divided into describing some of the science that might continue to increase lifespan. And then I get into some of the ethical reasons why you may or may not want to live to be, say, 120 or 150. And one of them is around jobs. So actually on both sides, people who want to live to be 150 say they have a lot of stuff to do. Mm-hmm. They have work to do and they want to, don't want to be.
That's me.
Have that end.
Yep.
And then on the other side, you get people who say they're tired already. I mean, when you, especially, I give them talks in places like public libraries and others where, you aren't getting the high achievers that one might find around here in Silicon Valley. And these people are having two, three jobs. I mean, it's a tough life.
Right.
And they certainly, they look at me like I'm insane to suggest that they might want to double their lifespan.
Isn't it like any other thing? These are choices. It's like, if I have a quality of life and I've got a lot to do, I'll want that life enhancement thing. If I have a miserable life, that's why, I really believe suicide should be allowed. People should be allowed to end their life when they want, assisted or otherwise. So isn't it just merely giving people another option to do what they feel is right for them?
Well, that's come up too. I've interviewed hundreds of people about how long they want to live, and actually asked a question at the beginning of my talks to over 30,000 people who have voted on how long they want to live. Yeah. And, then you get the reasons. And, the issue of, if I change something in my body by taking a pill or, adjusting my DNA or whatever it was that allowed me to live, much, much longer, but I decided I didn't really want that, would I be able to essentially turn the switch off? And that's been however you feel about that. This is what's so interesting, Marty, about all of this. Everybody has to start rethinking positions on a lot of issues when you start thinking about, both enhancement and this radical life extension. It's already changed our society that we're living a lot longer, if you think about it. You know, politically, Social Security, for instance, was never designed to, or for most people, to need past much past age 65. You know, we're obviously living a lot longer than that. And one small example of how this aging issue and then the enhancement issue are going to change things.
Well, I really like making part of the show, being ahead of the curve on things, especially if they're directly or indirectly related to career. And I appreciate, David Duncan, your contributing to that. So thanks very much for giving me a part of your Sunday. His book is When I'm 164, The New Science of Radical Life Extension and What Happens If It Succeeds. And he appears weekly on Biotech Nation on KQED. Thanks very much, Dave.
Great. Thanks, Marty.
Take care. Okay. And now I want to make sure we have time for you. As usual now, in addition to thinking big and thinking long term, we want to think right now and immediately. So if you have an immediate career problem that you're facing in your own life or someone you love, this is the time to call for what I call a 3-minute career makeover or workover. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I had a recent article in Bottom Line Personal that I wrote, which was called To Find a Job, Break the Rules. And it focuses on newer strategies, things that are not the, you know, it's kind of dispelling some myths that at least in the large number of clients that I work with all the time, I've now had a total of over 4,000, that I'm finding at least in 2012, the old advice that is no longer as valid. The old advice was, don't bother emailing a cover letter because, you know, now we've got these computers that are going to just screen your application. Here is the new advice, and it's better. Cover letters do matter. Of course, large employers, at least only the large ones really, screen applications by computer. But eventually, what happens is that the employer does end up looking at that, your application. And that cover letter, once it gets pulled out by the computer, which, by the way, should include a lot of keywords that would be impressive to that employer, the cover letter increases your chances of getting selected. The kind of letter that I suggest is the following. You start with something like, I was pleased to see this job opening because I am a good fit. You don't say perfect because that sounds like lying. Then you list the first major requirement that's listed in the ad, just as written in that ad. And below that, you explain how you meet that requirement. And you repeat that for each major requirement in the job ad. And then you say something like, oh, of course there's more to me than that. People say I'm whatever, and insert one of your desirable qualities. So I'm hoping you'll interview me. So please don't shortchange the importance of the cover letter, even in an era where so many employers are using computers to screen out applications. The phone number here, if you would like a 3-minute career makeover, any kind of work problem, whether you're a clerk or a CEO, whether you're 16 or 61, or even 71. You know, my father worked till he was 82 and was vibrant all the way through that period, so you're never too old to get a career makeover. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind? How can I help?
Hi, I'm on.
It is you.
Hi, my name is Melissa. I'm a clinical social worker in Oakland. I've called in the past about my various decade of experiences with nonprofits that have not always been the ideal and fantasy that many people think of the nonprofit world.
Why don't you enlighten all of our listeners? What makes the reality of working in the nonprofit world not what the ideal, the romanticized ideal you had?
Well, I'm a clinical social worker. My background is in social work, and at this point, I really work predominantly as a therapist. Mm-hmm. So I'm mostly around MFTs who are trained in psychology, and most of management is run by MFTs. And I can tell you, at almost 45, therapists are not best managers. I really think a lot of nonprofits would be run better with MBAs who maybe have that background.
By the way, for those who don't know what an MFT is, a marriage and family therapist. Continue.
Right. I've seen so many scenarios where managers try to process things with employees when it was really about the job and not about what your countertransference was.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not calling for a makeover. I'm taking my LCSW exam in 3 weeks.
That's a licensed clinical social worker exam.
Sorry, I'm assuming everybody knows this.
Right.
And I do intend to go into business for myself, not so I can make more money, but so I can do both the therapy and a lot of the social justice work that social workers really go to school for.
And here's
really
the question about that. I have a question about that. You know, there's so many people who are helping profession folks who would like to, you know, when you call social justice, I'm assuming that means helping the poor. But the poor can't afford to pay you a sustainable wage for you to do your therapy. How are you going to get funded?
Oh, well, I will always see a combination of Medi-Cal, sliding scale, and private paying. When I talk about my social justice work, I'm bilingual, and a big area of interest of mine is immigration reform. So my social justice work will really be volunteering, sitting on boards, writing articles, contributing in that way.
If I can make a suggestion.
More of a street-level bureaucrat.
Yep. And if I make a suggestion, I think all the studies, you know, I look carefully every day at Nate Silver's New York Times predictions, polls of polls. There is almost no question that President Obama is going to get reelected on Tuesday.
I hope so.
When he talks to Latino audiences, the first thing he says is his first priority when he gets reelected is comprehensive immigration reform. So we're going to have 12 million currently illegal, undocumented, choose your term, people who will now be, quote, to use again the term that he uses, coming out of the shadows. And therefore, there is going to be an enormous need for every kind of services, job placement, health care, and indeed psychological issues that they will then be qualified.
I see already. Yeah. I have so many undocumented clients who have fake Social Security numbers, have paid taxes for 30 years, done grunt work. I see it almost every day.
Right.
I work with predominantly Spanish-speaking single mothers.
But my point is that I believe that when they, quote, come out of the shadows, government will do a massive effort to try to provide the full range of services. And remember, under the Mental Health Parity Act, mental health services need to be provided to the same extent under health care as physical. And because Obamacare will then, once they're out of the shadows and made legal, they will qualify, those 12 million will qualify for Obamacare and therefore all kinds of mental health services. It is my judgment that Kaiser Permanente is going to be the main beneficiary of all of this, and that if you are interested in not necessarily spending most of your time doing therapy and not marketing, which most therapists don't, I would urge you now, before the flood occurs, to try to do networking within the Kaiser Permanente system to find out about how you can get hired to do therapy with the undocumented / illegal folks who will then quite soon, within a year, be covered under Obamacare. Does that make sense?
But are you familiar with Kaiser's current policies on therapy?
Yeah, they're restricted enough.
People leave Kaiser to come to me to therapy because they don't get enough services.
I understand there's a restriction on the number of sessions. And if that's anathema to you, of course, that's your right. But most therapists who I know hate spending the time on marketing. And building a practice in a world that is ever more Kaiserized, and it really will be, going to mean you're going to have to spend a lot of efforts marketing. And I'm wondering whether, at least as part of your existence, whether you might be wise to at least consider doing some of your therapy at Kaiser. Because remember, that's one thing Kaiser does. It eliminates so much of the bureaucracy and paperwork and accountability. You can do your job. I just went out last night at a party and spoke with three Kaiser docs, and they were all so grateful. They have no paperwork, they have no insurance, and that enables them to be doctors all the time. So I'm just raising that for your consideration.
Yeah, I will always keep them as a side possibility as a consultant. Once I'm licensed, a huge world will open up to me professionally that is not there. I have actually done very well as a private practice intern because I'm the type that markets like crazy.
Good.
Talk to everyone, gets my name out there. But my question to you, and it's not a makeover question, it's a just an important question, I think, for any mental health worker, is I've worked in the nonprofit world for 13 years. I left a national nonprofit in August that everyone would know the name of, so I'm not going to mention it, for a new job offer, which was rescinded because of a moving violation. So my question to you, and now I have a new interview process with one of the top training institutes, and all I've wanted in 12 years since graduating from social work school is for someone to invest in me the way I invest in them and their clients, is how do I exit the nonprofit world with grace? Because I've had a harder time than some people. I've lost, you know, thousands of hours from really corrupt administrators. Other people have settled out of court. I've resigned. I've been fired for notifying nonprofits that what they were doing was illegal and taking advantage of Spanish people. I would like to walk away when I'm licensed. And I know I've done great work in the last decade and the families have been worth it. But my opinion of nonprofits is so different than it was when I went to school 13 years ago. It's no different than, you know, Morgan Stanley, you name it.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, you know, people are people, whether they're working under an umbrella
exactly.
that's called nonprofit or for-profit, people are people.
They are.
They mouth things to the public, and then they act in their self-interest when it comes down, when push comes to shove. So the standard of, I wish I could say people want, employers want to hear honesty, but they don't.
They don't.
They don't. Very few do. There's always individual exceptions, but in my mind, you know, the pragmatic thing to do is to not badmouth your previous employer or the whole nonprofit sector, to say that you have, the more time you've spent in the nonprofit sector, the more you've appreciated the efficiencies that tend to accrue in the private sector, and therefore, while you've appreciated much about your work in that area, you're interested in working in a slightly more efficient organization, and that's why you're excited about working for them. That's the kind of balance that you can use to justify wanting to get out of that industry without doing any bad mouthing. Does that make sense?
It does, and there have been extraordinary people. Unfortunately, I can probably count on one hand, but people that have really moved me and shaped my career because they were such phenomenal mentors, supervisors. You know, as you said earlier, you're going to find, you know, people are people. They're going to be wherever they are. I guess my feeling and the way I work is that I care so much about this work. I want to graduate from the nonprofit world, put my own shingle up, and be able to go back to all those agencies and say, sure, I might supervise for you. I might consult. I might present. You know, I'm willing to put the bad behind us.
One little final comment before I say goodbye to you. You know, caring too much can hurt you. I was. Let me tell you what I mean. If you really can, not hurt you, but it can also hurt the people you want to help. I was originally a geneticist and a medical researcher, and I quit a fellowship at the Rockefeller University because I was caught up by the civil rights movement, and I quit that incredibly prestigious opportunity to work in the inner city and run drug counseling groups within inner city kids in New York.
Been there.
Right. And I cared so much because, remember, I basically threw aside what was an amazing career opportunity for a passion, and my passion hurt me. Because the kids could tell how invested I was in their success, that they saw that somehow perversely as a sign of weakness, and they saw that my passion.
Really?
When I was frustrated with them that they wouldn't, I was running these groups with 15 kids, and some kids would run around the room and fool around, and I would finally lose my temper and say, "Please sit down." And they saw that as a sign of weakness, and they would say, "You ain't my mama. You can't make me." And it was a nightmare. When I took a step back and realized that I can only control so much, and to restrain my passion, I was infinitely more successful. So I would encourage you to not let your unbridled passion make you more, too passionate. Just as, like, I would rather go to a doctor who was not so passionate about his career that he was kind of emotional, who was totally in control, rather than somebody who is too passionate. So passion is good, like everything else, to a point. Does that make sense?
It does, but I volunteered for so many years before I went to grad school that I feel like I have my passion in check. I have my boundaries.
Great.
I
Terrific.
Have my self-care, my coping. I never...
Then you were better than me.
Then you've had where my passion's gone unchecked.
Great. Then my advice was for other folks, not for you. I'm looking up at the clock. The show is over, so I thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. My thanks to my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course to all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute career makeovers on callers. And my wife, Barbara Nemko, and I are going to discuss the book, The Leader's Pocket Guide, 101 Indispensable Tips. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't. We'll be right back.